This is an audio archive edition of WINA's Charlottesville Right Now with Coy Barefoot, made available online by the Charlottesville Podcasting Network, cvillepodcast.com.
Grace Hale joins me live in studio. She's a historian with the University of Virginia. Her most recent book is A Nation of Outsiders, How the White Middle Class Fell in Love with Rebellion in Postwar America. And we've asked her to come in and discuss the situation in Wisconsin. Grace, thank you for coming back on the program. Let me help you with the microphone. Just pull it around there and get it right where you want it, all set up. Perfect.
Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. So the situation in Wisconsin, I say that, and people have been following this. There's a lot of ideology here, and I want to try to move past that into some real understanding about the history of what's going on. But first, let's talk with broad strokes. When we say the situation in Wisconsin, what do you take that to mean?
Well, we're in the 14th day of protests in Wisconsin. People have joined in those protests by rallying at state capitals in other states as well. The same issues that are on the table in Wisconsin are very much in play in Indiana and New Jersey, and there have been sympathy rallies even in places like Richmond. So I think that these protests, we could say, are a kind of either a last gasp of the labor movement or a new beginning. I'm a historian. I won't predict the future.
So when we talk about these unions, you know, we hear the news talking about, you know, private sector unions, public service employee unions. Of course, now we're looking at, you know, private sector unions. I think membership is down to like 6 or 7%. But still, there's well over a third of public service employees who participate in unions. We also hear this phrase, collective bargaining rights. Take our hand here, if you can, and take us back to the beginning and provide some historic context for what we're talking about in this language that we're using.
Well, the first important moment in this labor history that is really in play now would be the Great Depression and the labor laws that came out of that period. There was a great deal of labor organizing during that period, and the passage in 1935 of what is now usually referred to as the Wagner Act, which guaranteed private sector employees the right to join unions, create unions, and give those unions the power to bargain for them with their employers, which would mean settling everything from wage issues to safety issues, hours, working conditions, seniority and promotion issues. Issues of how people would be punished for violations of the rules of the workplace, those kinds of things. So you can think of the entire sort of workplace scenario as being up for discussion in what we have come to call collective bargaining.
And of course, that collective bargaining, since the Depression, and it may be before, I just don't know, but it gave us things like the 8-hour workday. It got children out of the workplace. It gave us the weekend. The weekend was actually created by unions, if I'm not mistaken, right?
That is true. Some of those victories came before the Wagner Act, but the Wagner Act really opened the door to the expansion of the private sector unionized workforce during the period after World War II through the early 1970s, a period in which I think it is important to note that the poverty line in our country, in 1945, 40% of Americans lived below the poverty line.
Wow.
After this period of rising union power, by 1970, only 10%, a little bit less actually than 10% of our population below the poverty line. So economists refer to this era as the Great Compression, 45 to 70, early 70s, a period in which our economy grew pretty steadily. And most of those gains, or not most of them, but a nice percentage of those gains were earned by the working classes and middle classes of our country. The top fifth of our earners in America during that period gained about 85% in their income. Certainly nothing to sneeze at, but the lower folks, the lowest fifth, gained 116%. Now, those just are numbers, but what you have in the period after 1980 is the reversal of that. The
yeah.
lowest income Americans losing ground as the rich have become the greatest beneficiaries of our expanding economy.
We're talking with UVA historian Grace Hale. Her latest book is A Nation of Outsiders, getting some historic context for the debate about public sector unions going on now in Wisconsin. And I just want to underscore something you said. I don't see how you can look at this history and not say that unions really helped to build the middle class in America following World War II, and that there, number one, has been a war on unions since the 70s and definitely 1980, and as such, a war on the middle class. And, we've seen no gains in the middle class since the 70s. I mean, we're working more and making less.
Yes, I think that these facts are pretty clear. Certainly in the 1970s, multinational corporations that are based in the U.S. Began to accelerate a process they began in the 60s, but by the 70s it had really accelerated of shifting their workplaces offshore where they could find lower wages and people who did not belong to unions that could bargain for them. Now, of course, this is interesting for public sector employees because it is hard for the state of Wisconsin to send its teaching needs offshore. You know, we can't have firefighters working for us in Cambodia or in parts of China. They have to be in Wisconsin,
which we've seen the private multinationals do in spades. I mean, that's been the story of the last 20 or 30 years, is taking the jobs that built America since World War II and going as fast as possible to the cheapest labor they could find anywhere in the world.
Right. And I will note that this is not a process that many of our competitors around the world have followed. Japan and all of the Western European nations followed a different path of trying to protect in very different ways. Their specifics differ, but protecting their workforces, protecting their key industrial industries, and not shipping these jobs overseas. But as a result of that, the public sector has become the last bastion of the labor movement. And as you said, over a third of public service employees, close to 37% is the latest figure I've seen, belong to public sector unions. And these unions, like the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees, are really the last strong institutions that are a part of this over century-old U.S. labor movement.
Grace Hale is live in studio. She's a historian with the University of Virginia's Corcoran Department of History, and her latest book is A Nation of Outsiders. We're discussing the little historical context for the situation now going on in Wisconsin. The debate about unions, is it balancing the budget or is it a war against the power of unions? Grace, it seems like a lot of news people are using shorthand to sort of make this out to be a Republicans versus Democrats. But if I understand you right, what you're saying is there's been a lot of Republican icons who've actually supported the labor movement.
That is true, and particularly—
And specifically unions, yeah.
Yes, and particularly we could point to, I believe, Richard Nixon, who really set about courting the what he thought of as the blue-collar workforce, the industrial workforce, and really thought of his policies as separated between social and economic issues. And in terms of economic issues, he was really trying to support these what he called the silent majority, the steel workers, the mine workers, the lunch bucket guys, Joe Hardhat, I guess, as he would be called these days. And Nixon did many things like approving laws expanding Social Security and Medicare that the unions wanted. He helped was the president that signed into law the Occupational Safety and Health Administration, you know, the founding of that administration, which went to work on workplace safety issues. So he did a lot of things for the labor movement during his term in office and was followed by President Ford, who also did things to support the unions. In particular, he was he refused to follow the plans of his own Secretary of the Treasury, William Simon, who wanted to end the double taxation of dividends. And Ford said, absolutely not. This is a handout to the rich. I'm not going to support that at all. We're not going to change that policy. So the idea that this is a Republican-Democratic issue really is a much more recent way of looking at the facts.
Yeah. And then, of course, when Reagan came in, everything changed. I mean, that's what we've certainly seen over the last 30 years is this really a war on the middle class, on the power of the middle class, really economically speaking, from the right.
Absolutely. And Reagan is really the key, although I think that some of that war does start under Carter. I was singling out the Republicans to talk about labor policies. Policies the Labor Department supported that those Republican presidents also supported. But Carter, I think, could be seen as the first Democrat to really turn away from labor. He didn't have any close ties to the labor movement. They had not originally wanted him to be the nominee. They didn't support him, and he really never supported them. He was very lukewarm on labor issues. And if you think about things like the airline deregulation process, which happened under Carter, all of the unions involved in the airline industry heavily opposed that, and Carter pushed it through. So some of what it certainly accelerated with Reagan and the PATCO strike, the firing of all the air traffic
Now,
controllers.
What do you think when you hear somebody like Scott Walker tell whom he believed was David Koch is a big investor and financial supporter. Turned out to be a crank call, but he thought he was talking to him, and he was talking about Reagan's fight against the air traffic controllers in the early 80s and how Walker really saw himself as a 21st century Reagan that was going to bring down the unions.
Well, I think that's exactly right. That's a story that his actions in Wisconsin can be seen as another chapter in that fight that Reagan opened with firing the PATCO workers in 1980, because those were public service employees, the air traffic controllers, and already in 1980, that was where the strength of the labor movement was building. Those were the unions that were actually growing in membership, the public service sector unions, and Reagan took them on. Now, public sector employees do not have a national right to collective bargaining or to union organizing. The Wagner Act does not specifically apply to them, and their rights come most of their workplace rights come out of state law, and that is why that these governors can take them on in the state capital.
Which is why in Virginia, for example, the unions, the public sector unions, they have no power, basically. I mean,
well, they have no power
have
in Virginia
at all?
For those reasons, and also because we're a right-to-work state, which would have to do with the Taft-Hartley Act and amendments to the earlier Wagner Act. So public and private sector employees don't have many union rights in Virginia.
We're talking with Grace Hale, a historian from the University of Virginia, some historic context for the war on unions. I guess the part that baffles me the most, really, is to see middle class and working poor who are very engaged in politics, and yet ideologically speaking, they couldn't be further to the right. So they consistently vote against their very own economic interests. They continue to support people who continue to use laws to fight them, and puts them in a position now, 30 years since Reagan, where they work more and more and more for less and less and less, and yet they always blame, as far as I'm concerned, they're blaming the wrong person. They should be blaming the people they're voting for.
Well, they certainly do tend to blame cultural issues, moral value issues. Those have been so powerful in the last 20, 25 years of American politics, 30 years. And in part, I think it's because of our two-party system. All of the issues get divided into two positions. And that doesn't give people who are economically liberal, Joe Hardhat, to use the somewhat problematic shorthand, it doesn't give him anywhere to go if he's anti-abortion, doesn't like boys with long hair, think of the 60s and 70s and the hippies, and yet really wants policies like national support for full employment, more interest in solving the unemployment, lowering unemployment rate than worrying
about
inflation.
So Nixon and Reagan used a lot of those social issues to bring these guys, men and women, working men and women, over to their side, but then they consistently did not deliver in terms of the economics. All the economic policies went against them.
Right. Well, to some degree, I'd say Nixon did some things. He didn't deliver as much as Democrats before Carter, but definitely after Nixon, yes, from Reagan on, do not deliver. Absolutely.
Yeah. So really quick, we got about a minute left, but if Walker is successful and takes away the collective bargaining rights, takes away the rights of these people to come together, which I see as a First Amendment issue. It says in the First Amendment you have the right to petition your government for an address of grievances. And to me, that's what the collective bargaining rights is. I have a right to stand before you as a worker and say, you're not treating me fairly. And so to me, it's a First Amendment issue. But if it takes these rights away, what happens next?
Well, it's a major, major, major blow to the labor movement in the U.S. Because it will clearly be followed by other Republican governors in other states. Indiana's already done it, maybe not to the fullest extent of the changes that the Wisconsin governor is trying to make. But without collective bargaining rights, it's hard to see how these public service unions will continue to have any power whatsoever, why people will stay members and pay dues.
Yeah,
to
it just becomes a club.
Exactly.
Grace Hale, her most recent book is A Nation of Outsiders, How the White Middle Class Fell in Love with Rebellion in Postwar America. Grace, thank you so much for being here.
Thanks for having me.
You've been listening to Charlottesville Right Now with Coy Barefoot. Charlottesville Right Now is broadcast live Monday through Friday on News Radio 1070 WINA from 4 to 6 p.m. Best-selling author and historian Coy Barefoot is the host and producer. To interact with Coy and his guests, you can call 434-977-1070. Coy can be reached at barefoot@wina.com. This audio download has been made possible by the Charlottesville Podcasting Network. Visit seavillepodcast.com for more.